Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, and this hour is for you. If you've ever felt alone and lonely or brokenhearted, like this.
Dave had been with this person for about 8 months, so it was a pretty significant amount of time.
This is Lauren Howe, with a story about a friend of hers. We'll call him Dave.
At first, it seemed, you know, like everything was going very well. He kind of disappeared from our friend group for a little bit, and we assumed that was because the relationship was very happy.
But then, Dave's girlfriend dumped him.
She ended up moving away and breaking it off, and then later he found out that she had started seeing someone else a couple weeks after she had moved away and broken up with him.
And Dave was just destroyed. And for a while, he couldn't even get out of bed. He just lay there, obsessing about what went wrong.
He started questioning whether she ever really loved him. You know, she told me that she loved me when we were together. Was that all a lie? Was I just the wrong person, and now she met this other person who she's head over heels with? Was it just that I was wrong the whole time?
Luckily for Dave, Lauren is one of the best friends you could have if you're going through a breakup, because she's a grad student in psychology, and recovering from heartbreak is precisely what she studies. And Dave's story is not all that uncommon. I mean, we've all been there, right? To some extent, we're all nursing wounds from lost relationships and painful breakups. And yet the fact that it's a universal experience somehow does nothing to dull the pain.
When we're with someone in a close relationship, we start to treat them like they're a part of ourself. Our identity overlaps with their identity. And I think that's one thing that makes rejection or breakups really sting, is that you feel like you've lost a really big part of yourself.
So as part of her research, Lauren got more than 900 people to tell her about their breakups. She discovered that some of them had never really recovered, and that those people had something in common. They all told the same kind of story.
They felt like through the course of the breakup, it unearthed some kind of terrible truth about who they really were, some kind of deep-seated flaw that they had that they thought would affect future relationships.
And on the other hand, Lauren says the people who'd bounced back or moved on after a breakup, they told a different kind of story. They talked about how they'd grown from the experience, how they changed.
Exactly. Just because one thing doesn't work out doesn't mean that it necessarily reflects on your worth as a person or kind of reveals some pattern that's going to repeat itself in your romantic future.
So going back to Lauren's friend Dave, Lauren sat with him a lot, and mostly she encouraged him to tell a different story about himself and his ex. And it wasn't a miracle cure or anything, but it helped. And Dave's better. And that's the point of Lauren Howe's research, that it's the stories we tell ourselves that largely determine how well we handle heartbreak and loneliness. So, today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're changing the script, making the case for the lovelorn, the loners, the bachelors and spinsters, that there is nothing, nothing wrong with being alone.
You can be lonely anywhere, but there is a particular flavor to the loneliness that comes from living in a city surrounded by millions of people. One might think this state was antithetical to urban living, to the massed presence of other human beings, and yet mere physical proximity is not enough to dispel a sense of internal isolation. It's possible, easy even, to feel desolate and unfrequented in oneself while living cheek by jowl with others. Cities can be lonely places, and in admitting this, we see that loneliness doesn't necessarily require physical solitude, but rather an absence or paucity of connection, closeness, kinship, an inability for one reason or another to find as much intimacy as is desired.
This is writer Olivia Lang. She's just written a beautiful book about urban loneliness called The Lonely City. And her story begins when she moved from England to New York after a painful breakup and discovered just how lonely you can be in a crowd.
I became really fascinated by urban loneliness. I became aware very quickly that I was, although I felt like the only person in the world feeling those feelings, I knew intellectually that I wasn't by any means, that it's a common, in fact, a very common experience. And so I grew increasingly interested in getting to grips with it and understanding how it was working and what it really means.
Mm. Well, take us deeper into that feeling itself, because I think we all kind of know what you mean, but I don't know, bring it alive for us, would you, that feeling of being alone in a city, even though you're surrounded by people?
There are metaphors they keep coming back to, and one is being behind glass and one is being walled up in ice. And these are metaphors that you see in all kinds of different people's writing about loneliness. And I think the reason for that is that the feeling of loneliness is a combination of longing for somebody else, longing for connection, longing for intimacy, longing to be loved, and at the same time feeling hyper-exposed in your solitude, hyper-exposed in your failure to have achieved what our culture considers so incredibly important, a romantic coupleship. And I think that combination for me, the sense of separation, the sense of exclusion, but also the sense of being hyper-visible and ashamed about it, I think those are really the key themes of loneliness, the keynotes of it.
What did you do with yourself? You'd moved to New York. You didn't really know anybody.
Well, no, I mean, I did. I had friends in the city. And I think that's important to say as well that, you know, my life was not completely desperately isolated. And I think that's true of many, many people who suffer from loneliness in our society, is that you can have friends, you can have a busy work life, you can even have a partner. It's not necessarily going to stop you longing for that kind of deeper intimacy or deeper sense of being known.
I know exactly what you mean. You've taken me straight back to my junior year in college. I had a summer internship in Alexandria, Virginia, and I had never been there before, and I didn't really know anybody. And I sublet a studio apartment. And the days at work were fine. I mean, I was busy. I was meeting people. But the nights and the weekends, I remember just standing at the window, looking out over the dark city and feeling like the only person alive. Except, of course, I could see other people and lights. But I also remember feeling in some strange way that this feeling might annihilate me, which sounds like such an overstatement. But really, it felt like I was just going to, I don't know, splinter, disappear somehow.
Yeah, and I don't think that is an understatement. I think that's another really key thing. I mean, the research on loneliness really shows that we are social beings, and it is absolutely devastatingly emotionally dangerous for us to become that level of isolated. Loneliness has huge physical effects because it is so difficult for a human to live like that. And this is not to say that happy solitude is bad for us. It isn't at all. It's the actual feeling of loneliness that really is the problematic thing.
I liked the point that you made that it's simultaneously a feeling of being invisible, you know, behind glass, cut off from other people, and also being terribly self-conscious, almost as though you've got a, you know, big target on your back that says, you know, alone, loser.
Loser. Yeah, God, I felt like that often. And I mean, actually, it was interesting you saying weekends, because I think weekends were so different from in the week. I felt like it was fine to be in cafes on my own or be walking around the city on my own or any of those sort of things. But at weekends, it was like it was family time or it was couple time.
Oh, it's everybody's coupled on the weekend. It's a terrible time to be alone.
Yeah, it's really tough. And I wouldn't go to the places that I normally went to because it would just feel so brutally exposing to just be like, yeah, here I am, a loser.
Yeah, but why? Why? I mean, you've made the point that we all feel loneliness at times. Like, you don't get out of life without experiencing loneliness. So if it's this universal experience, why do we feel so ashamed of it?
The shame is the key thing, I think. And this is what it took me years of wrestling, really, to get to this point of realizing that actually the most painful thing for me about loneliness was the shame. And the shame is unnecessary. It is an absolutely universal experience. I really don't think there are many people in the world who at some point in their life, whether it's because of bereavement, whether it's because of the loss of a friend, any of these things, will experience loneliness. There isn't a need to feel shame. And I think an awful lot of the shame is cultural. And it's appalling, really. It causes so much unnecessary distress. Loneliness is hard enough as it is, but the shame is not a necessary thing to feel.
Yeah, but it's not just that we feel ashamed of it. There is a social stigma attached to loneliness, right? I mean, people will reach out to somebody who's grieving or depressed, but it's as though someone who's lonely has cooties. You don't want to catch it.
I think it gets so deep into our fears of how life could be that we will do anything to ward it off. And part of that is creating a stigma around it.
Yeah, and thinking of all the negative stereotypes we have, you know, mm-hmm. crazy yeah. cat lady, yeah. you know, weird guy who lives in the basement, you know,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And those sort of social stigmas, I mean, the more I sort of looked at that, the more I realised that we're demonising people who are lonely, we're pushing them away, we're making them more isolated, and it's unkind.
Well, one of the places you went as you began to kind of want to explore the experience of loneliness more and understand it better is you found that there are certain artists you really gravitated to who maybe did more than the psychologist to kind of probe the depths of loneliness. One of the first ones you write about is Edward Hopper, the classic American urban realist. What drew you to Hopper's work?
Hopper was really the gateway for me. I mean, I began this whole different way of looking at loneliness. I wanted to see what a different kind of personality had said about it, a different kind of temperament. And I thought, if anybody, I mean, he's the patron saint of loneliness, really, of the lonely city. And so I started with Night Hawks, which is that exquisite painting I'm sure everyone has seen at one time or another.
But describe it anyway.
It's a diner seen from the outside at night with these four people inside it. And they are in this sort of uneasy grouping. They aren't communicating with each other. There's a very strong sense of how isolating cities can be. But the thing that's particularly interesting to me is that the viewer is trapped behind glass. The viewer is on the other side of this group, this lit up space. And so you get this kind of empathic tremor of loneliness. Looking at it, you get a sense of how it feels to be shut out, to be excluded. And I just thought that was the most fascinating painting.
Did Hopper write much about loneliness and the experience of it?
He talked very interestingly about Night Hawks in particular being just how I saw a city. And the person who was interviewing him at the time was saying, well, are you lonely? Is that how you feel? And he said something really interesting. He said, I probably am a lonely one. And I loved that, because while confessing to his own loneliness, he was also making it absolutely clear that he wasn't the only lonely one. There are many, many lonely ones. And this was the point where I realised that the lonely city is a populated place. There are all of these different individuals in his paintings, all experiencing loneliness in different ways.
So there's another artist I wanted to ask you about. You spend a lot of time, kind of immersed yourself in his work, and that's the painter and photographer David Wojnarowicz.
Yeah.
Well, I think I wasn't familiar with him before I picked up your book. Who was he?
Well, I think he's the most wonderful artist. And he has been very underrated and under the radar in America and in England. But he came from a broken home again. He was a street kid in New York in the 60s. And he was gay, and he felt very much violently oppressed and stigmatized. And he spoke up against that. His work speaks up against that. His work is very much about those sort of themes of isolation and resistance, which I think is why I was so deeply drawn to it. So he wrote books, he painted, he took photographs, he made films, he did performances. He's sort of this Renaissance figure of astonishing creativity. And then in the 1980s, he was diagnosed with AIDS. And this is when an AIDS diagnosis was a death sentence. So the final period of his life was really about resisting that. And this is where stigma comes in again. Part of the reason I wanted to write about David and look at David was because so many of the people who get stigmatized, it's around the body, it's around being ugly, it's around being ill, it's around having disabilities. And AIDS is an example of one of those sort of conditions that meant people were staggeringly stigmatized, rejected and isolated by conventional society. So in Close to the Knives, Wojnarowicz talks about people dying on hospital trolleys in corridors because nurses wouldn't tend to them. So these are the sort of experiences where you see isolation and loneliness in a totally different light. It becomes something much more political.
Your sense of connection to him and his work in particular was really intense. I mean, while researching that, I mean, you just immersed yourself in his life, his records, diaries.
Yeah.
What did that do for you?
It was absolutely wonderful. I was working in the archive at New York University, which has all of his papers. And One of the things that they had was the taped diaries that he made when he was dying in the last couple of years of his life, and they were astonishingly intimate. So he turned this machine on and he'd just start talking into it in a sort of stream of consciousness way, sometimes very distressed. You can hear where it sounds like he's been crying at some points. But if art does anything, it makes connections between us, it makes connections between strangers, it makes connections between people who will never meet. And that time, you know, where I was having an unhappy time in my life and I was in this archive listening to this person struggling with all these diverse issues, some of which crossed with my own, helped me. It helped me to feel less isolated and less ashamed. It was astonishingly connecting.
Isn't that fascinating that your experience of feeling less lonely happened when you were getting close to somebody who you could never meet?
Yeah, and yet, you know, his voice was speaking in my ear. I mean, one of the things, and actually I ended up reading this quote years after I'd finished that part of the book, but he said to his friend Nan Golden, the photographer, she said, "What do you want from your work?" And he said, "If it makes somebody feel less alienated, that's all I want." So that is what he'd kind of laid out, and I was the recipient of it. I mean, we want connection in all sorts of different ways, don't we? And I think one of the kind of deep ways that we can be touched by another human being is by our art, and that doesn't necessarily involve meeting somebody and touching somebody physically, but you are touching in some sort of way. So I think it does dissolve the glass in a sort of way.
Olivia Lang is the author of The Lonely City: Adventures in the Art of Being Alone. Some of us have to learn how to be alone. Others can't wait for everybody else to leave. Writer Annalee Rufus cherishes her solitude. She's also the author of a manifesto for her fellow loners.
It's so simple to me, and yet for some people it's so impossible and intolerable to understand. It just means I get most of my energy when I am by myself. I feel natural, I feel revived, I feel peaceful. Doesn't mean I'm a misanthrope. It doesn't mean I'm incapable of being around people. It doesn't mean I have social anxiety, kind of the opposite. It just means I get my energy from being alone. In my opinion, being a loner is not really the same as being shy. It's like, I could do it. I don't really want to. I will if I, quote unquote, have to, because I'm a stranger in your land. I'll do it to be polite and to not look like a freak, but I'm not shy. I just don't want to talk to you. What is weird is the amount of prejudice that still gets leveled against loners in our society, and that is a whole nother story. Why is that? So often, I have found people leveling judgments based on people's preference for being alone, to the point of accusations. Oh, he must be crazy. He must hate people. He must have social anxiety. Well, you know, maybe not. Maybe there's a positive thing about it. Maybe that person, he or she, just feels fine, feels good when they're alone, to the point where they're getting more stuff done. They're being more creative that way. They're being more mentally healthy that way. You know, that's one way to look at it. There is so much in our culture association between doing crazy stuff and being a loner. People are scared of it because it's different. They wonder, what are you doing alone? What are you doing there? I don't understand it. It must be something bad because I can't think of anything good to do when I'm alone. The rest of us, we loners, are like, oh yeah, you know, I read, I make stuff, I think, I walk in nature, I just sit peacefully, I meditate. But non-loners are like, you must be doing something weird. Generally in my life now, no, I do not feel loneliness, and I cannot remember a time when I was lonely. Maybe I missed a person who had passed away or had moved away, but lonely, that feeling I've heard so much about and so many songs are written about and that I hear about, I do not know that feeling.
Journalist Annalee Rufus is the author of Party of One, The Loner's Manifesto. Coming up, what one adventurer learned on a solo walk halfway across the globe. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about being alone in this hour, and for writer and educator Parker Palmer, solitude is an essential ingredient of life. Parker's a Quaker, so he's used to sitting in silence, but every now and then he needs more than just a meeting's worth of quiet. He just got back from a week-long retreat in the winter woods of Wisconsin, and he stopped by our studio to talk with Raymond Tangekar about what he gets from being alone.
I go off on solitary retreats and try to take solitary time fairly regularly. And as a writer, I have this time to process what's going on for me in the external world, to make sense out of it, to make meaning out of it. And I think that's part of what happens in solitude. There certainly have been times when I went on a retreat following a period of real turmoil in my life. And on those occasions, I took the turmoil with me, and it took time for things to settle out. And those can sometimes be very difficult days.
Well, I mean, you kind of brought up one of the dangers that I imagine comes with seeking solitude, in that depending on what kind of state you're in, you're also bringing some baggage with you. I mean, you can seek some kind of personal enlightenment, or you can just be alone with your inner critic.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there are states of mind when it's really not a good idea to go on a solitary retreat. I speak from some experience on that because, as I've written and spoken about, I've experienced deep clinical depression. And at times like that, it's dangerous, I think, to be alone. But if we're talking about sort of normal states of mind, I find it very sad to hear people say, "I'm afraid of solitude," because the only way I can translate that is to say they're afraid of being with themselves, and they need the constant distraction of a device or a home entertainment center or another person or a crowd to sort of keep their minds off themselves.
Do you ever feel lonely when you're alone?
Well, there certainly have been times in my life when I have. But in my work, I find it very, very important to think my own thoughts. And so the solitude is an important piece of finding out, well, what is it that I have to say that isn't just a paraphrase of what someone told me yesterday? What is that fresh, original angle on whatever it is that I'm thinking about, wrestling with, writing about?
To be entirely honest, you know, I really enjoy solitude as well. I feel really at ease and alive when I'm like alone hiking or exploring a new city by myself. But whenever I do that, I can't help but feel somewhat guilty. I mean, it's this idea that my time could be better spent, you know, with a partner or volunteering or building houses for the needy or something. Do you ever sense that type of guilt and this feeling that seeking out solitude is selfish in some way?
I think I used to feel that way when I was younger, but I came to the understanding that anything I can do to care for myself is ultimately being done on behalf of other people. I mean, I want to be a good husband. I want to be a good father. I want to be a good grandfather, a good friend. And I can't do that if I'm burned out, if I'm depleted, if I'm empty, if I'm on the edge of despair. And so solitude, or whatever it may be, that helps keep me away from those dark places is ultimately, I think, not a selfish thing at all, but a service to whoever it is that I want to serve. We can't be in service 24/7 and survive or be sustainable.
Is there a way to seek out solitude without feeling disconnected from the world and the people around you?
Yeah, you know, I think there is. One of the insights that came to me as I've become more deeply connected with myself, what's come to me is the realization that I can be in solitude when I'm in a crowd as long as I'm closely connected with myself.
Well, can you unpack that for me? I mean, how do you maintain that solitary mindset in a crowd of people or, you know, when in the quote-unquote real world?
Yeah, I think it's a matter of not losing track with yourself, of staying connected with what Thomas Merton would call your true self. There's the false self that's the ego self, the one that wants to look good, and then there's the true self that is there, for example, to serve or to be of use as one can be to others. Let me try to give a concrete example. I've always enjoyed speaking to large groups, and I've done a lot of it. 5,000 doctors in a big hall down in Orlando. But it used to be that when I was in situations like that, I would be very anxious, very nervous, and because the questions I was asking were all about me. Do they like me? Do they like what I'm saying? As I thought into that and as I reflected on that in solitude, I realized that I could get up behind a podium in front of a big crowd and ask a different question. And that question was, how can I best serve these people? And as soon as the question shifted from how do I look to how can I serve, which is why I'm really here, that paralyzing anxiety started to disappear. And something purer and truer started to take its place. Now, I would argue that in that situation, I'm staying closer to the fundamental impulse of my own soul. And in that sense, I think we can be in solitude even when we're with others. When I'm in solitude, it's not that all the people in my life disappear. It's actually that what's important about the people in my life becomes clearer. And I think of them with probably deeper affection, deeper respect, deeper gratitude than I do when I'm engaged in the busyness of everyday life.
That's funny, though, that physical distance for you it sounds like it's necessary to deepen your relationships with others.
Yeah, I think it all starts with deepening my relationship to myself. You know, I don't think you can have a genuine relationship with another person if you're not genuinely related to yourself. And from the other person's point of view, who is that person relating to if you're not really standing in your own truth, if you're not really grounded in your own soul? So again, anything that you can do to take care of what Thomas Merton calls true self is being done on behalf of other people. I deeply believe that.
Writer Parker Palmer, talking with Raymond Tangekar. Parker's the author of the books A Hidden Wholeness and Healing the Heart of Democracy. There are a lot of ways to experience solitude. Parker likes his retreat in the woods. If that sounds a little tranquil, even a little tame to you, how about some high-stakes solitude? That's what Sarah Marquis was looking for when she set out to walk 10,000 miles from Siberia to Australia alone. It took her 3 years. She survived brutal winters, sub-zero temperatures, blinding sandstorms, drunken nomads, and dangerous drug dealers. But she made it, alone, on foot, with nothing but a cart and a backpack. Steve Paulson talked with her.
Sarah, you did this amazing feat of endurance that few other people would even dream of trying to do, a 3-year, 10,000-mile walk that stretched from Siberia to Australia. What did you hope to discover during this journey?
Well, I think it was more like a dream than I wanted to achieve, you know. I wanted to see where my feet can go and where my feet can take me. And I've been doing this for the last 23 years.
Now, it's worth pointing out that in many of these countries you were walking through, it's practically unheard of for a woman to be walking alone, let alone a Swiss woman carrying thousands of dollars worth of gear, of supplies and equipment. Did you feel like you were a walking target as you were on this huge trek?
Yeah. Well, it's been a bit of a journey, I would say, because I had trouble in Mongolia, for instance, where I've been attacked every night for 2 months in my camp. You know, just before the night starts to fall, then they will arrive at my camp drunk on their horse. And
so these nomadic riders in Mongolia would come, you said every night? And what?
Yeah, for 2 months.
How did you fend them off?
Well, they're really scary because, first of all, they are drunk. That was the problem. So you just have to do the unexpected. Sometimes I will actually surprise them and cry really loudly to the horse, and the horse will rise, you know, on the back feet,
mm-hmm.
and they will make a destabilization on the guy on the horse.
Do you try to scare the horse to throw the riders off?
Yeah, because you can't scare a drunk Mongolian guy. You can scare his horse, yeah, but not him.
It's just amazing to hear you describe this. I mean, you must have always had to be thinking on your feet, you know, probably sort of planning possible escape routes, you know, just to defend off these people who could really create major problems for you.
Yeah, and after 2 months, I decide I need a plan B, definitely. I can't go on like that because I was not sleeping at night, see. So I find a way because I've been hiding under the road. You know, under the road, you've got those big concrete tubes.
Mm-hmm. No, like culverts.
Yeah, exactly. So I was sleeping under the culverts at night. So nobody never came under those roads to look what was going on underneath there.
And you had a tent with you. I mean, you could camp out wherever.
Yeah. I can, whatever. I sleep like a baby normally when Mongol man on a horse don't come to disturb me.
What did you do about food?
Well, food, I've been carrying my food, but most of the time it was difficult to do any resupply because Mongolian man and woman and the family over there, they eat meat. And I don't eat meat.
Oh, you're a vegetarian.
Yeah. And so the thing is, I've been eating a type of biscuits, really, really dense biscuits, like a cookie, big, massive cookie. And that biscuit saved my life all the way because I had tea and my biscuits and that made me happy. I had a full tummy. That's all I wanted.
Wait, just talking about your time in Mongolia in particular, were there especially scary moments when you really wondered whether you were going to survive?
Oh, yeah, those moments were there. And but, you know, you switch. You go from, oh, I'm going to be careful here, to surviving mode.
Yeah, tell me about one or two of those instances.
Well, for instance, in a jungle in Laos, I had the dengue fever. So it's really high fever. And you go through a stage of really, we call that delirium fever.
Mm-hmm. Delirium, yeah.
And then after 3 days, I survived. So I attached myself in a tree because I knew I was near a river and I knew that I could actually get to some really high fever where you don't really know what you're doing and what you will normally do. You will jump in the water to get cooler. And to avoid this, so I attached myself like a dog nearly to a tree to make sure that I was all right, you know.
Wow.
So then after that, I decided to just took off again through the jungle. And then after a week, I find this perfect spot near a little pond of water, clear water. So that night I was tired and exhausted and I thought, oh, this is the perfect spot. I don't have to clear anything to put my tent. I'm going to sleep there. And in the middle of the night, I hear some voices coming through and I wake up and here they are, 15 men, really tiny little men. So those tiny little men, sweating men with a headlamp, just tried to pull me out of the tent. And I thought, you know what? Those little cheeky men, they're little men. I'm going to stand up. That's it. And I'm going to yell at them, you know, like, I want to sleep. You know, I was cranky. I want to sleep. And I stand up and I yell at them. And suddenly I hear in the air this gunshot going on. Like, they had an automatic gun and they let the shot get out. And I was like, holy I'm not in a good position here. I must change what I'm doing. That's not working.
So what did you do then?
So it's a long story, goes on for 3 hours, but to make it short, I realized they were drug dealers and they were moving drugs quietly at night and drinking water from where I was. And I took this little diary that I had with me. Inside, I wrote some phrase from different type of tribe who lives in the jungle there. And I took the tribe's name where I was, and I had this three phrase writing in it, who say, "I'm from Switzerland. My name is Sarah. Do you understand me?" And I've been saying this phrase really slowly, over and over, like a mantra, you know, to calm down everybody, with the same voice, the same level of quietness, and lower down my energy and keep calm. And 3 hours later, they start to walk off, and I was alive.
So were the people that you met, or at least some of the people, did they pose the bigger threat than just having to deal with nature, with the harsh environmental conditions you were running into?
Yeah, the biggest fear for me was actually human, never been nature. I had those amazing encounters with nature. I've never been frightened by nature. Unfortunately, human has been another story for me there.
Yeah. Now, you spent most of these 3 years alone. I mean, on these long walks. I mean, sometimes going for days at a time without seeing anyone.
Yeah.
Did you get lonely?
Well, this is a process, see. So for the first 6 months, I've been like through really difficult time with my body and my mind. It's like being in a wash machine where you're just tumbling in inside. And so months goes, and then suddenly one morning, you wake up. And there is not you, your body, your pain, and your tent, and the Gobi Desert. There is one thing out there only. It's like a little ice cube who actually melt, and you're part of everything around you. So loneliness, it's not part of that plan. So you become the sand, you become the wind, you become so close to every living things around you. And it's this incredible feelings just make me believe that we all got this same thing. And most important, it is that we all got the same address. It's the planet Earth.
So finally, you ended your journey in Australia. Were you a different person by the time you got to the end? Did this change you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Can you explain that? I mean, how were you different?
I think I get lighter.
When you say lighter, not taking things quite so seriously, what do you
exactly
mean?
Uh-huh. Something like that. You know, we are not serious in the right spot. You know, we're not serious enough for serious question, and we are serious for little thing. You know, and I think little thing doesn't matter, doesn't change the course of your life. That's what I mean by lighter. I mean, taking things more like they're coming to you and dealing with it, but in a good way and with a lighter spirit and more wisdom. You know, the wind in Mongolia teach me a lot about the wisdom of the wind.
So once you got back home, once you got back to Switzerland, mm-hmm. did it feel kind of boring to be back in the modern civilized world?
Oh, no. I enjoy every bit of it, you know. First of all, you open the fridge and there is food inside. I like this concept of having food at hand, you know. It's quite cool. And everything is there. But it needs a little bit of adjustment, see. Adjustment regarding my senses. Because by the time I come back home, my hearing system will be really able to capture noise from every corner of my surrounding. So going back to a coffee shop, for example, is quite complicated.
Hmm. It's really loud, I guess.
You can hear everything. Yeah. Huh. And you can hear the wash machine in the background. You can hear the kids screaming on the left corner. You can hear the chair moving on the floor, you know. So all my senses are quite high developed.
Most of these stories that I hear, I'm just wondering, why do you do this? I mean, you are risking death, obviously. You are constantly on high alert, you know, incredibly difficult circumstances. You're dealing with all kinds of stress. I mean, is it worth it?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's a physical journey at the beginning, and it's become really quickly amazing, incredible inner journey where you test yourself, because by doing this, you're acting outside of your comfort zone most of the time. And if you don't get out of that comfort zone, you will not experience superior level of your capacity, because we all can do so much, but we don't test ourselves. And by doing that, you discover that there is so much out there. And out there, it's actually inside you most of the time.
Adventurer Sarah Marquis talking with Steve Paulson. Sarah's memoir is called Wild by Nature, From Siberia to Australia, 3 years alone in the wilderness on foot. You'll also find videos of her walk on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, a new novel about a pack of angry homeless teenagers roaming the wilds of the American suburbs. They call themselves American Werewolves. I'm Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. And now, a post-recession, post-housing crisis novel about alienated teens and suburban fears. Kirk Lynn's debut novel, Rules for Werewolves, is the story of a group of young, homeless, angry kids running from their families and roaming the suburbs of Los Angeles like a pack of wolves. Here's how it begins.
Chapter 1. Susan tells Bobbert how to become a part of the pack. Hey, it's cool. I'm not going to hurt you. I just want to let you know you can't sleep there. Why not? It's going to get cold tonight. I'm doing all right. You're in the parking lot, huddled up between a dumpster and the walls of a speedy stop, without a roof. You're not doing as good as you think. Why don't you come with me? Where are we going to go? I have some friends. They have a house. Not a house they own, but just a place where we can stay. There's about 20 of us sleeping there, maybe. Look, it's not legal. If someone catches us in this house, we have to be ready to run. And if one of my friends tells you to do something, you have to do it. Or be sure you could win a fight against that person. What do you mean? You'll see.
Kirk, that's such a great beginning for the book.
Well,
so when people ask you, what's your book about? What do you answer?
I typically just go straight forward and say I wrote a book about kids that are squatting in houses. And I say that they're playing a game where there are werewolves and the game sort of gets out of hand.
And I've read that you have some experience of breaking into empty houses yourself.
Yeah, when I was a kid in San Antonio, Texas, basically anytime I was driving around, if I saw a house that was for sale and it looked cool, I would go check it out and see if I could find a way in through a window or some way in and unlock a window. And then later at night, either would on a date or with friends when we were going out looking for a place to drink a few beers, we would go back into that house. It was never to like destroy property or to do any graffiti or writing or anything, but just to have a place where you could be like, this is our place. I mean, I literally would pretend on the like date nights that like this was my house and this is how I was going to live someday.
Wait, did you do this a lot?
I did it a fair amount. I mean, I tried to estimate for my agent, like maybe 30, 40 times.
You're
like,
kidding.
Over the course of like junior and senior year when I was driving.
So what made you want to start with this idea and then turn it into a novel?
I mean, I think I'm somebody who longs to be a different person in a lot of ways and to change myself. And I think werewolves was a great metaphor for like change that isn't necessarily good and that you're not necessarily in control of. And also, I'm a person who likes my I love my family. I love my friends. I like being in groups that I feel like not only do I belong, but like anywhere they go, they'll take me. Mm-hmm. And so I think the idea of a pack also really suited me of like, if you can find your people, those moments when you find the people who like, not just open their doors to you, but like, you know, bring you inside and you're just in with your people. You're like, oh, that's such a great feeling.
So this group of kids, your characters, they think of themselves as a pack. They talk about mating and pair bonding and making the change. They talk about being werewolves. So the last chapter actually is the rules for werewolves. There are too many to read all of, but do you have any favorites?
Oh, yeah. Oh, let me flip to that. If two werewolves fight each other, they both die.
because every werewolf is the exact same strength as every other werewolf, and werewolves can only fight to the death. You don't have to get bit by a werewolf, but it helps. And I like, later on, I like, sleep when you're so tired you collapse, eat when you're so hungry you attack, die when you're dead.
I like, werewolves live off nature. They look at your home and they see a nest full of eggs.
When I was writing the book, I had the great pleasure of like walking through the world and just thinking like, if I was going to steal anything I could get, eat anything I could, like, you can see the world in this completely anarchic, fun way of like, where would I sleep tonight? And what would I steal? And there's so much that you can just sort of like swipe.
Really? So do you wind up walking through your neighborhood and looking at your neighbor's possessions or thinking, it'd be so easy to just take that car?
Honestly, a favorite activity of my wife and I mean, we're suburbanized. We're sober citizens. But we love to take walks, especially at night when we can look, you know, not creepily, hopefully, look in people's windows, but just see how other people live with the lights on in their houses and who's sitting down to dinner and who's watching TV. And yeah,
oh, you're reminding me of this great scene in the book. It's pretty early on. Somebody's walking down a suburban street at night.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody's watching the same show, and you can tell because the same lights.
The curtains, yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're synchronized house to house.
I mean, that's a real experience of walking around at night on Super Bowl night, and everybody's doing the same thing, but in their separate houses. It's pretty amazing.
Is it amazing or is it creepy?
I mean, my knee jerk is that it's a little bit sad in some ways, especially like the houses. Like if there's a big party and everybody's watching the Super Bowl, and then right next door there's somebody sitting alone watching the Super Bowl, that's sad. And then, you know, like in the book, one of the things that the werewolves get attuned to is like if everybody's watching the Super Bowl and there's one house that's dark or there's one house that's watching something else, or like that's a vulnerable house. Those people aren't with friends or lined up with people.
So these werewolves are teenagers, whatever. Yeah. They're definitely on the feral side. And some of it is amusing, but also kind of sad. Like they break into these places filled with jacuzzis and freezers filled with food and big screen TVs, and they watch all the videos and they ransack bathroom cabinets and kind of trash these places like, you know, big overgrown animals run amok.
I think it's pretty sad too. I mean, as a kid, I was really obsessed. I read every summer for the longest time, I read On the Road. I thought it was the greatest book ever. And then came to one summer when I read it and I was like, oh my God, this is the saddest book I've ever read. That all this running around drinking and thinking they're having a good time is actually quite lonely and sad and dispossessed. And so I think the freedom I think that the werewolves long for is not necessarily to be found in stealing these things, but the greatest freedom they have is actually when they bond with one another, when they feel tight with someone else, when they feel like somebody will protect them or take care of them.
I guess what I'm asking is, what is that freedom, that wildness that, you know, shows up in things like On the Road?
I've been thinking a lot about the notion that maybe it's all a myth, but the idea that there used to be a time when you could, if you weren't doing well where you were doing, you could strike out into the frontier and go into the wilderness and make your own space, make your own way in the world. And that has, we've sort of exhausted the wilderness, much to the wilderness's dismay, and that the new frontier is in sort of behavior. I mean, one of the big, I think, attractions to the metaphor of the werewolf is I was once a big drunk and drank terribly and had these violent transformations that were brought on by alcoholism. And the great thing about quitting was that, you know, I got to be a new person. But it was interesting to see the people who were, there were people who were less willing to let me be a new person that you get sort of surprised by. They're used to certain behaviors from you. Not just like, oh, Kirk needs to be drinking, but like, you should be louder and wilder and crazier. And like, well, that may not be who I want to be today or for the next 20 years.
You were saying you used to read On the Road every year for years. And I was thinking there's that tension, maybe in all stories, that tension between home and away. You know, people are either looking for a home or they're leaving a home. But, you know, something has to happen. And it almost always involves leaving or looking for a home.
Yes. And these people are literally homeless. I hesitate to say that it's just in your teens and 20s, because I think it, unfortunately, I think happens multiple times in most people's lives where you have this sense of not feeling like you belong at your place of work or, God forbid, in your marriage or your family. I think most people relate to this sense that we have to find their own home, or this isn't my home right now. These people, I need to go find my home, whether it's another marriage or another place to work and make your living or another group of friends. I wonder if it's our nation is obsessed with it because of the nature of like sort of making our own home here.
Right. But I do think there's a long, I mean, there's so much longing about having, I was looking through sections, I'm going to do a reading tonight, and there's so much longing for, like, let's have a farmhouse, or let's, you know, we'll be with each other, we'll camp out. There's all this longing for, like, a space where, like, there'll be a rest in some way.
Could you end by reading us a little bit from one of those sections?
Yeah, let me flip to one. I want you and I to have a place of our own, a house. You know the way a cul-de-sac is? With all the fronts of the houses facing one another really close in a circle. But out the back doors we'll all have big farms fanning out like a pie chart. And you and I are the hunters for the group. And you and I go out for a couple weeks at a time and set up a little camp and live off venison jerky and water from some nearby creek. Most nights we lie on a blanket by the fire and we stare up at the stars. And in the morning when we wake up we don't say a word. Silently we'll roll up our blankets and go out into the fields and wait for the deer. We always know where the other one is, so we don't accidentally shoot each other. And when we get back, there's a big barbecue, and we eat some of the deer right away, roasted over an open fire, as we butcher the rest of it to be smoked. And then everybody tells us what happened while we were gone. And we have wives, and they tell us what happened with our kids while we were gone. And we're not gone that much, but it's our job to go sometimes.
That's their fantasy, is to both be at home and also be able to leave it.
Yeah, to have both at the same time. I mean, that's why novels are so beautiful to me, is you can sort of sit in home in your bed and you can travel insane distances and over insane times, yeah.
Kirk Lynn talking about his new novel, Rules for Werewolves. He is the artistic director of Rude Mex Theater Collective, and he teaches playwriting and directing at the University of Texas at Austin. That's it for this hour, but there's more in our podcast feed. To subscribe, look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. That way you'll never miss a show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced this hour, with help from Craig Ely, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Until next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.